Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Litecoin Underground podcast. This episode, we've got Matt Aalborg from BitRefill, who, if you don't follow him and pay attention, he puts together these extremely useful threads about usage on BitRefill. Now, we're talking about BitPay a lot in the Litecoin community because Litecoin has taken over as the number one crypto on BitPay, the most used. In BitRefill, we're seeing some of the same trends. Are we number one? Are we number two? No, but we're far ahead of where we were, you know, a month ago, 6 months ago, a year ago. It's just continually growing. So they're seeing the most usage they've ever seen on Litecoin at BitRefill. And we kind of dive deep into this. This is a two-part interview. I broke this up into two episodes. The first half, we talk a little bit about BitRefill, but a lot about just privacy and mWeb and what that might bring and kind of some of the use cases around the world. And the second episode is going to be more into the statistics of BitRefill. And then we talk a little bit about his pay-per-Q, which is like an AI. You can use your Litecoin to go basically use premium AI, image generation, that type of stuff. So overall, really cool interview. Matt and I have been chatting for a long time, and you know, I'm always pushing them to try to get new things in BitRefill. I'd recommend you reach out to people when you're on Twitter, or maybe you're on Facebook or Telegram or Discord. You know of somebody that has a service that isn't offering Litecoin, or there's something you'd like to see them add to Litecoin, like Mimblewimble, VPM, that type of stuff. I've been trying to push them for zero confirmation transactions. It never hurts to ask. You know, I know you don't want to pester people, but I think it's a good thing to just make it known that, hey, there's people out there who would like to see this as a part of your offering. But don't do it if you don't intend to use the service. You know, I think it'd be bad to say, hey, add Litecoin, and then nobody uses it. You know what I mean? So, as always, I got to talk about Cake Wallet. Cake Wallet's really coming to the forefront right now. mWeb, or VPM as we're calling it, is getting added to Cake Wallet. You can go test it right now, but I mean, it's like supposedly within the next week or two, it's going to be live. And these guys are always trying to be on the forefront of adding service and options and making their UI better. And so I'm always happy. I'm not saying that just because I'm a sponsor, they're a sponsor, but also because I use this wallet consistently. So it's got all in one. It, as they say, see, I'm going to tell you when I read what they tell me, because if I just say it myself, it won't sound natural. So they make using crypto a piece of cake. You can spend your crypto at hundreds of places with gift cards using Cake Pay. If you haven't used Cake Pay, it went away for a while and it came back. So you can go in and buy a gift card of the exact amount that you're going to use. So you go to a restaurant, you include the tip, boom, boom, you're done. You don't have to like carry these gift cards with excess balance around all the time. It's compatible. It's got mobile and desktop operating systems and privacy features, Bitcoin silent payments, Monero, VPM, or mWeb as some people like to call it. You can do custom nodes. You can coin select in the wallet. All those great things. They just continue to add, it seems, and that's always great for the user. So, all right, very long intro. Sorry to bore you with it. I'm excited for this episode, and come back for more. I appreciate you guys listening always, and follow and subscribe everywhere you can, and have a good one. Bye. All right, hey guys, everybody, it's back for another episode here of our new Litecoin Underground manifestation with Animal. Myself, and this week we've got Matt Aalborg in from BitRefill, I guess head of data and research, according to his handle there, his tag. And we're doing a couple things. We're going to cover not only a recent thread he had that really laid out statistics for BitRefill. I mean, you make one of these maybe every 3 to 6 months or something like that, Matt. It's very extensive. Obviously, as Litecoiners, we're seeing usage grow on all these platforms. BitRefill is not any different, but it's really interesting to understand maybe why that's happening. And that's what I like about Matt. And he and I have actually been chatting for quite a while about a number of different things. I'm trying to push him to make you know, call it light refill. He just refuses. But maybe lit refill would be better. But and then he's got also a new kind of pay-per-view or pay-per-queue, he calls it, AI model, where you can use your Litecoin to basically engage with premium AI without having to have a monthly expense. Just use it at your convenience. So, Matt, thank you for coming in. What is your exact, or how long have you been with BitRefill?
Oh, yeah, I think at least 3 years. I think going on 4 years. I think I joined right after COVID began. And I started off in a part-time capacity and then transitioned to full-time. And then last year, I transitioned back to part-time so I could work on a few projects that I wanted to do on my own. And PPQ or pay-per-queue is kind of what I chose to go with for the last year. Yeah.
Can you give me like a little, I mean, I don't know how much, if you've been there for 4 years, what's the history of BitRefill? Was it, I know it's one of the biggest, is it the biggest probably crypto company in the world at this point?
Well, so in terms of commerce payments, we believe we are. It's hard to get data on that. You know, a lot of companies don't share that type of information, but we made kind of a guesstimate. I think we were looking at like Alexa statistics, like how many visits each of our, you know, competitors was getting and that type of thing, and kind of made a guess that we were probably the biggest. BitRefill has been around for almost 10 years now. That makes it a dinosaur in crypto years. We started off, or BitRefill started off selling mobile top-ups. So you could bring Bitcoin and you could buy mobile data, mobile minutes in many different countries around the world. That wasn't like a huge hit. This was all before my time at the company. But as far as I understand, it had some steady growth, but it was never really a big thing. And then eventually we added gift cards. And gift cards were the thing that kind of lit the fire for BitRefill. And I believe that happened in late 2017, early 2018, something like that. Maybe it was almost till 2019, actually. But the gift cards were the thing that really kind of lit everything on fire with BitRefill. Ever since then, we've just been iterating on expanding our product line. We had U.S. bill pay come online last year. To the extent that you could pay your electric bill, your water bill, your credit cards, all that stuff with crypto, we had to pull back on that. For some regulatory reasons, you know, crypto winter in the U.S. and Operation Choke Point, and I'm sure you guys have all heard of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of that flavor of things. But we've added other products. We have eSIMs now, where anywhere in the world you go, you can top up your phone with your SIM card, basically digitally. So you land at the airport in whatever country you're going to, and you can instantly like have a month plan of data to work with. So, we just keep expanding as much as possible to different countries, different products. We're here today. We do think we're the largest commerce company in the whole space. And so when we offer like a myriad of different payment methods, we feel like we can make some good observations on like the trend of the space as a whole. You know, mm-hmm. for every new coin there is, there's so much hype around each coin, and it's very hard to tell like what is hype and what is real. Solana is like, you know, if you ask Solana people, Solana is like going to eclipse Ethereum very shortly. But, you can pump a lot of those numbers if you're on those projects. So, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, I think it's one of those things where there may be these digital native assets that live in the digital world, but for some reason they don't translate to the physical world. I think we were talking about that on our spaces on Wednesday. You weren't in there, but you know, one of the things that when Satoshi called it Bitcoin, like I think he very much was trying to tie this to the real world.
because he could have called it anything he wanted, you know. But choosing to call it a coin, I think, is interesting. And I wonder even if that has an impact on how people view them as, like, you know, Litecoin, Dogecoin, Bitcoin. These are money, where these other Solana, Ethereum kind of live in this Web3 world, and they are less likely to use them in the real world, maybe less likely to accept them, type of thing. But so for the most part, you're just dealing with people that they're choosing, obviously they're converting their crypto in some way into ideally a real world good, right? Whether it's a cash card or it's going to be at a specific vendor. Do your merchants, merchants themselves, do you guys engage with merchants in any way that you facilitate them receiving payments, or is that not part of your game?
I think in a very small scale we do. For the most part, though, we deal with these middlemen that aggregate a bunch of different merchants all at once. So we might, you know, we might have a Best Buy card. And,
yeah.
And we're not buying them from Best Buy directly. We're buying them from, some sort of middleman supplier who works with Best Buy, that type of thing.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we can get into that. I think we should dive into this thread because it is
A
little extensive, you know, but that's, in my opinion, that's a really good thing. So if you guys aren't, you should follow Matt. Your tag is, well, let's go to the top of this. Hold on. I think it's right at the beginning. It's got your picture up there, which you look different. You shaved, I think. Oh, maybe not. Maybe not.
Yeah, I had a little more of a beard back then, but
Matt Allbor, you're younger too, probably.
Yeah.
I've been younger. Every single picture of me is younger. That's an old Mitch Hedberg joke, I think. every picture is in the past. All right, an old picture of me. So I don't know if you want to try to go through this as a. We'll try. I think it's doable. It might take a little time, but I do think, like you said before, we were on camera here, that each slide has its reason, right? And we obviously put some work into them. So this is just, when we talk about volume, total volume by payment method, let me try to describe your, maybe you can get, what do the slashes and dots mean here?
Yeah. So each color is kind of a different payment method. Each texture, the slashes and dots, those represent different types of layer two assets. So I think that the, if you scroll down, it'll tell you, but there are various types of stable coins.
Solid colors are crypto assets. So your solid beige.
Yeah, that's like Ethereum or Bitcoin or Litecoin.
And here's Ethereum.
Yeah, the dotted texture represents stablecoin tokens.
Okay.
And then the backslashes represent layer two crypto asset. So that would be like Lightning is like a layer two pure Bitcoin, right?
Okay. And this is Polygon stable.
Yeah. So Polygon, we kind of consider like it's technically a side chain of Ethereum, but we consider it to be in the Ethereum ecosystem.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, the big story here is the chart goes from 2020 all the way up until now. You can see that back in 2020, Bitcoin was the vast majority of our payment volume. And now it's like a much more multi-coin world. Bitcoin is still bringing in a significant amount of our volume, but it's actually been eclipsed by mostly the Ethereum ecosystem, and chiefly because of those stable coins that the Ethereum ecosystem offers. You know, people like stable coins, they like paying with stable coins. That's kind of the biggest takeaway from this chart.
It's a little tough to see, but I mean, like I'm looking at this, it's been pretty flat, if not down. And this is a percentage of total, or no, this is total payments.
This
so
is
there's
total,
some sort of you know, thousands over here or something that we don't.
Yeah, we're
number of payments.
Yeah, volume.
Volume.
So it's dollar volume.
Okay.
We don't reveal the y-axis. It's kind of, you know, every company has to make its decisions on how much they're willing to release. But
everybody values privacy, Matt. We all know that. Optional privacy is something we all deserve and should exercise. Okay, so that's that's total dollars by, yeah, and I'm obviously using Bitcoin as the foundation. You can see it's been pretty flat, maybe a slight downtrend. With Lightning, it's pretty flat.
Yeah.
Ethereum's all over the place, probably based on the price of Ethereum, I would guess.
Yeah, we do see when the price goes up on these assets, we do get more sales. People are, you know, I guess selling off more of their profits, that type of thing. That's a, definitely a phenomenon on our platform, but that's not the the sole thing going on. It's just one of the larger factors.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's hard to tell here what, obviously Litecoin's this area. It's hard to tell where it's growing. I think you bring that up later.
In the next slide, you can see the monthly active users and how there's these different events that that trigger spikes.
Yep.
Like the launch of Chivo in El Salvador.
Exactly. Yeah. So when that happened, every person in El Salvador got $30 in Bitcoin. And so a lot of those users, we did a good job marketing there. And also the users are very clever. So they figure out like, what's the fastest way I can like spend this Bitcoin thing that that this person just gave me. So yeah, you'll see different peaks and valleys and associated with different events over the years. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, that's, I mean, you mentioned like people getting out of their profits. One of the things I've found really kind of fascinating about Litecoin's growth across all these platforms is it's come at a time when there hasn't been any price appreciation. Mm-hmm. If anything, price has been compressing over the last 2 years, and yet we're kind of rolling over into this era of usage. I think we're getting a lot less speculation, and you're seeing it even in Bitcoin today, where the price just isn't quite taken off like everybody's hoping it would. And mm-hmm. some of these alt cycles, it's just like the fun BS seems to be gone, but I mean, that could come back. I don't know what the next, we can always roll into another speculative mania. You know how this works.
Yeah, I think with mania, I think the world's population gets a little smarter each time. And so mm-hmm. the mania mm-hmm. is a little less pronounced each time. And yeah, regarding Litecoin, it like basically very few coins, and there are shades of gray in this, but almost all of crypto has been pure hype up until now in terms of the proportional amount of good that it delivers the world. It's a lot of it is based on hopes and promises and hype. So every cycle has been governed by that. The price of all these assets has been governed by that. And so we are maybe for the first time entering a phase where like actual fundamentals start determining the direction of the price of the asset. And so, you know, with Litecoin in particular, you're right, it's been on a downtrend in price for years now. And this is something that's mystified me because I've been at BitRefill watching Litecoin grow steadily over the years in terms of number of users. And I see all these other companies like BitPay showing the same thing. So that shows, you know, statistical significance of a trend, right? When multiple mm-hmm. sources are showing the same thing. And yet the price has gone down still. And I think what that tells me is that up until now, the market is very much governed by hype. And mm-hmm. and Litecoin, very similar to Bitcoin in many ways, doesn't have a lot of that hype around it. It's boring, so to speak. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I kind of mean that in a positive way.
Hey, I live it.
You know, it's a clone of Bitcoin, and over the years it has diverged and done some interesting things for sure. Mm-hmm. But there's no sexy like founder. There's no like, you know.
Bob, I wouldn't say that about Charlie. Come on.
Yeah, yeah. My bad, Charlie. My bad.
Well, there's no Michael Saylor. There's no guy buying billions and pumping it daily. You know, with millions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it didn't benefit from an ICO where like 20% mm-hmm. of the coins are dedicated to marketing and, you know, basically tricking people into investing in said coin. Mm-hmm. yeah, it's I think that that's probably why, you know, Litecoin has gone down over the years in terms of price. but maybe we're entering a new phase where people actually start looking at fundamentals.
I hope so. Yeah. That is the hope. Like, as people become more and more aware of what these things are, as they learn what the difference is between a token and a coin, my hope is that they'll gravitate towards things that are harder than, you know, a token, mm-hmm. that aren't just being pumped by, you know, millions of dollars of the creators' bags, right?
Yeah. I read, so if you go to coinmarketcap.com, you'll see the little icon for each coin. And this is a website that most popular web price listing website.
Right.
And yeah. You'll see Polkadot is like number 12 or 15 or whatever it is. And it's the only one that's animated. The coin is like, it's a little GIF where the coin, it shows the animation. Mm-hmm. And when you actually look into the budget of Polkadot, they paid like something like $700,000 just to make their little coin animated on that website. It's just, wow. It's crazy and sad and ridiculous all at the same time. Just shows you like the kind of budget that these, you know, that these coins have. There's so much money that was pumped into, you know, you look at projects like EOS, like nobody ever even talks about EOS anymore. And it's sitting on like an insane amount of Bitcoin still that it collected in its ICO back in the day.
Yeah. 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 My thought is with the, you know, the speculation does run out. You know, one of the things that I think there's a couple things that have happened in Litecoin's history that I don't know if they were conscious decisions or not. But just sticking so closely to Bitcoin is probably one of the best things that Charlie did by not messing with the code too much to make it so simple to implement. And if you look at like ATM availability, Litecoin's even ahead of Ethereum, it's number two, and it's not far behind Bitcoin. And so I think that's probably been the best thing they've focused on, is that it's everywhere, so that there's that familiarity. There's that kind of stand, you know, it's been around a long time. I can trust it. It's reliable. And the best advertisement for it is to use it. You know, people just go, I look at these like dips and we'll, we'll probably go into this. I don't want to drag this out too long in this, but you're going to see as those we've seen this price spikes and fees on Bitcoin, people move to Litecoin and they don't come back. Like a certain portion of them don't go back to Bitcoin, because like fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Right. Once you've paid a $10 fee, you're like, well, I'm just not going to do that anymore. I'm just going to use Litecoin. Why would I mess around with Bitcoin? It's slower and more expensive. And so that's been the best thing. It's like that.
Unless you're denominating in Bitcoin, as you believe it has, you know, it has the ETF, it has all of this. Right. Brand name recognition. In that case, you would have, you know, your main stack would be in Bitcoin, and then you'd transfer over to Litecoin. That would be like your checking account, which is kind of, to my understanding, mm-hmm. the whole concept behind Litecoin. I kind of want you guys to tell me a little bit. Like, I'm traditionally a Bitcoiner, and I have been for since my inception. Like every altcoin kind of its community has its own. You know, like characteristics and personalities and stuff. And like, for a long time, I saw Litecoiners as kind of like very similar to Bitcoin Cash people, but maybe I think there are maybe differences. You know, maybe the Bitcoin Cash people were a lot more into the big blocks than maybe Litecoin people were. Or like, can you tell me, like, what is the personality of Litecoiners, and like, how did they develop? And yeah.
Animal's been a Litecoiner longer than me. Why don't you go ahead?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I really turned into a Litecoin. Like, I always liked Litecoin. I started mining Litecoin back in the day because my Butterfly Labs miner took so long to get delivered, right? I waited like 2 years for that piece of crap. And in the meantime, I just bought myself some GPUs, and the only thing I could do with them was mine Litecoin. So that's what I did. But I really became focused or more dedicated to it after the hard fork, after Bitcoin Cash, just because I felt at that point that Bitcoin had lost some of its integrity. that the community was fractured and consensus was broken. So, yeah. And at that time also, Dogecoin had just been merge mined with Litecoin, right? So I saw these two communities where these two chains on the one hand were acting antagonistically towards each other. And on the script side, they were acting cooperatively. And I just thought that was a better bet long-term. So yeah, beyond that, what I think what's setting Litecoiners apart from Bitcoiners these days, in some ways, sadly, is the concept of self-sovereignty, right? Being able to custody your own coins and not having to depend on a third party. I think most Bitcoiners, if they're using Lightning, are using it through a custodial service, because setting up your own node is not practical unless you're doing a ton of volume, unless you're doing a bunch of transactions. Hosting your Lightning node is expensive and prohibitive. Like, a lot of channels require that you have some usage, right? A certain mm-hmm. amount of monthly transactions.
Channel size or something like that.
Yeah. And to maintain okay. that, it's just, even for someone who's technical, it's a pain in the butt and expensive, mm-hmm. right? Like, so yeah. From a self-sovereignty perspective, from like an original, I want to say like from the perspective of Satoshi's original vision, right? Where like you want to do peer-to-peer transactions, Litecoin is better suited than Bitcoin is these days. And that's kind of, it's controversial maybe. I don't think a lot of Bitcoiners will agree to that. But from my perspective, at least, that's, you know, that's what I see.
Yeah. Well, as a Bitcoiner, the thing that pops into my head when you say those things is like Litecoin is the same as Bitcoin, except four times bigger, right? So it's not solving a scaling problem. It's only like a temporary band-aid.
Well, right. And maybe the answer to your original question that also answers that is that, well, we have Mimblewimble, or what we're calling VPM, which is an extension block. So that scales even further. That actually trims the nodes long term. So like the activity on MWeb can be condensed. Sorry. A lot more. I don't understand the technicals of it, but essentially they consolidate all the transactions that happen on MWeb to a much, much less data on chain long term. Mm-hmm. I say this about all coins. I don't understand why everyone thinks today is the final form. Openness to change and an ability to get community momentum in Litecoin is much easier than Bitcoin. Not only because the community is a little smaller, there is some value in the fact that Charlie and this the Litecoin Foundation, if they get behind something, it generally is going to get more momentum. So that may sound like a really silly thing to have that kind of, I don't know.
I think though
like that a wise sage in a way. But like, so things like we've talked about drive chains, they've been talking about a Bitcoin for 8 years and it can't happen. You can barely get Opcat that was already on Bitcoin. So that stagnation and the problem is the community's become so laser focused on price. They don't want to mess with anything. And yeah. In my opinion, that's really, you're putting yourself in a big disadvantage. And I've said this just on Spaces Wednesday, if fees start to go up on Litecoin, if it gets full and we start to see fees go up, I don't think it's a smart idea to say, let's turn away customers because fees are too high. We should be open to saying, all right, let's go to 2 megabytes mm-hmm. until we do find a solution. Cause like if Bitcoin had not said like Lightning's the future today, let's just double block space until we figure out Lightning.
Mm-hmm.
Think how much more users would be on Bitcoin today if it never got to 10, even 20 cents, 30 cents, that starts to just feel very expensive for someone in these parts of the world we're going to talk about. And I know what you're saying when you're going, hey, people want to make this Bitcoin their unit of account. But if you're actually using the money and you're losing 1, 2, 3, 5% of your money every time you spend it, you're not saving anything, you're losing. So 2% times 100 is all your money. You know?
I think there's so many gray areas and trade-offs, but you know, my Litecoin would have all of these problems if it got to the size of Bitcoin. I feel like it, the community would be much larger. You wouldn't have a wise sage as to the degree, and the wise sage might become the evil emperor, you know, for all we know.
True. Yeah.
And, you know, so you're always going to, the bigger you get, politics are always going to become a bigger thing. So I do agree though, that there is, you know, Bitcoin's ethos has been kind of like, you know, it has become more price obsessed, but I think that the same would happen to Litecoin if it started skyrocketing in price. You would start seeing a cabal of people in Litecoin say, like, let's just keep this price increasing and screw everything else. And yeah, they would become a very powerful block of people, I'm sure. It's tough to say. I do think there is some, definitely the cultural difference. There is a real cultural difference between Bitcoin and a lot of other coins, and there is more willingness for change on, in particular coins and stuff like that. But
do you think that Bitcoiners would be so resistant to block size increases had Bitcoin Cash not succeeded in forking, if Bitcoin Cash weren't around, for example? Like, because so I feel,
give me the question again.
So okay, let me just tell you what my thought behind it is. You know, Bitcoiners right now, they're really against increasing the block size. Like, it's kind of taboo to even discuss such a thing now, but beforehand, before Bitcoin Cash, it was a discussion that people were having.
Yeah,
it was considered a viable solution and almost a necessity over time that, you know, block size would be done, right? Like, it would have sounded silly. But given that Bitcoin Cash succeeded in forking and has survived this long, there's a question of saving face that Bitcoiners are doing now, where, like, they can't admit that they do need a block size increase. They kind of painted themselves into a corner with that. And so they're forced now to develop laterally, right, with L2s.
I think that, and I obviously can't speak for all Bitcoiners, but I do think you're starting to see the tide turn a little bit with a lot of the very hardcore Bitcoiners to accept that, obviously, Moore's law and all that stuff, our computation powers getting stronger, bandwidth increasing exponentially, memory increasing exponentially. You know, most people, most very smart people in Bitcoin acknowledge that it's okay to increase the block size on a long time scale. You know, I would be in favor of maybe, you know, 100 kilobytes a year or something like that, or just something that kind of conservatively increases it on a progressive basis. And I do think that the Lightning, it has, most people agree that it's not going, I don't think it's a failure, but I think it's not going as well as a lot of people hoped it would. At least for me, I did live the dream of, I wanted everybody to have their Raspberry Pi Lightning node, and I wanted, or at least on their phone to run a Lightning node. And, you know, we have made improvements on the Lightning side, but I mean, we still struggle with basic things like offline receive and liquidity management. And there are many problems that I think I would have expected them to be like a little bit more solved by now. But maybe I'm just too impatient. I don't know. But I do think that maybe going, if you were to go back in time and you saw that Bitcoin had like 80% of the entire market at the time of the big Bitcoin Cash fork, and now it's down to, you know, there's like thousands of altcoins, and the Bitcoin dominance, even though it has been rising in the last year, it is nowhere near where it was in like 2017, right? So maybe there would be more people who would have said like, wow, we should really rethink, how strict we're going to be with this block size thing. I think at the time, yeah, I was on the Bitcoin Reddit back in those days, and that's where that was the center of the conversation, right? Mm-hmm. And I was won over by small blockers, and I'm still a little bit leaning that way because I think the thing that Bitcoin has is very precious. And if you go too far in a new direction, then you can ruin it all. And so I saw the technologists in 2017, they were the small blockers, and the businessmen and the economists were kind of the big blockers. And so I just said, well, I defer with the technical guys a little bit more, but I do think maybe there was a little bit too much conservativeness, because I also think that there are so many way more centralized coins that seem to be getting away with it. I was very pessimistic about, like, I thought the governments would have cracked down on us a lot harder by now. So I thought that decentralization was like just absolutely paramount, and we need to maintain that, because the governments are really going to come at us hard. But I haven't seen that. I've seen maybe we haven't seen it yet, but from what I've seen is like governments are disorganized. They can't do things quickly. They're very stupid. They don't even understand what's happening most of the time. I think now they're starting to really understand what cryptocurrency is. But up until like 2022, most governments still just looked at it as this toy plaything, and they didn't see it as any threat to them or anything like that.
Yeah, now they think they can get the votes, so they're paying
attention. We did an interview with a guy who created the Breadcrumbs app, which is kind of a tracking software that he developed for the common man. And he says he works a lot with local police who are trying to track down people who defrauded other people, right? Like retracing where the funds ended up kind of thing. And he's like, they have no clue what's going on. You talk to them, they don't understand this stuff at all. It's like for us, I don't understand the tracking, but it's fairly simple if you can tell the story properly. But it's just kind of the second you start getting into technical jargon, it's people black out. And I had a guy on Spaces last week. He was talking about, he said, well, just go to GitHub. And I'm like, dude, that's where you lose me. I don't know. I'm not a developer at all. I consider myself a smart guy. I look at that GitHub thing and all those libraries, and I'm like, I don't know. I don't know where to begin.
Yeah.
So just, you got to think about what you're dealing with. But you can only rely on that for so long, because what happens is the less knowledge they have, the more likely they are to crack down more harshly. And even the general public will go along with it, because they'll just say, like, look, Monero's being used for all these business hacks that are billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So Monero's no go. Now, okay, it becomes MWeb on Litecoin. We got to be aware this is going to, I think like you, I think it is coming at some point in time. And Tether has ingratiated itself with the Fed essentially by buying US bonds. And so I think they're getting a pass there. And maybe that's the right way to do.
Law enforcement too. They're freezing addresses when the government wants them to, and that type of thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's where MWeb has a difference, right? Because it's opt-in. So anytime you want to go to an off-ramp, you go to your Coinbase or Kraken and stuff, you can peg out straight from an MWeb wallet into your Coinbase or into a Coinbase account.
Coinbase can know that it came that way, right?
Yeah, they will. Yeah.
So that's kind of the same problem.
They can kind of know
because it'll come from a Litecoin address. It'll come from an LTC address.
Won't it come from the it'll come from the MWeb address? So like, if you didn't know, if you look on the blockchain, every block on Litecoin, there's an address with like, I don't know, 80 or 70,000 Litecoin. That's the MWeb address. So when you peg into MWeb, you're just sending, essentially the MWeb client is sending your Litecoin to that address, at which point there's something that tracks all the coins in there, right? So yeah, when you peg out, you're sending from that address and Coinbase receives from it, right? So they know.
I don't think that's true. I don't know that that's true. I don't know if it moves into your, I think maybe it sends pegs back into your main wallet and then your wallet generates a new address, but I could be wrong. And if not, maybe you got to take that one step. That might be a feature on a wallet to say, send to my main and then send out next block kind of thing.
Even if you take a step, like there, it's tainted, right? It'll be tainted with the MWeb address, right? So like,
every tech that I've ever seen, there is a way to tell that it comes from, if it's mixed, if it's, you can tell using Chainalysis and whatnot.
Exactly, yeah. But so my point with that was that you can receive it. And Coinbase, if it's a large amount, they're going to question you about it. They're going to ask you, where'd you get this? Literally, there'll be a pop-up on your screen. It's like, you got to tell, we need some more information, buddy. Right. And so that's how I think that's how MWeb will survive, because people will either, at that point, they'll have to disclose where they got it from, or if they can't, then they'll get busted, right? So the on-ramps, and the off-ramps rather, and the fact that every Litecoin is mined in the ClearNet space, I guess, I'm gonna call it like non-private, transparent ledger, kind of makes it so that, you know, when you're coming back to an exchange, they've colored the coins and they have the right to ask you the right. I guess that's what it is.
Yeah, it's similar to Lightning. Really, that's how Lightning is. Anything can happen on Lightning that's untracked, and when you come back from a Lightning channel, it's the same. I mean, I don't see what the difference would be.
I think there is a difference. If you're paying a Lightning payment through the Lightning network and it ends up at a place like Coinbase, I think it is harder to track in many cases, because the way Lightning works is you have very limited information beyond the node that you are connected to. So Coinbase is connected to some outside node. They know that outside node, and I'm sure they've signed agreements with that outside node, certain KYC AML type compliance agreements, but they still don't see if that company, it's very hard to prove that company is following those things to the T. And it's very hard for that company to enforce those same rules on all of the nodes that it's connected to. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating discussion about like how different network topologies can achieve true privacy and true untraceability, and to what degree you can get that untraceability and not piss off regulators, right? Like, I find it very interesting how like Mimblewimble, it's not only a privacy thing, but it's also a scaling thing, right? So you can kind of market it to regulators as like, well, we did this thing for scalability, and yeah, it increases privacy a little bit, but it's mostly for scaling. And the same thing with Taproot on Bitcoin, Schnorr signatures, and you're achieving privacy, but you're also achieving scalability at the same time. So it's a little bit easier to make an argument with regulators to accept these types of things. And I think that's how the winning coins will do these moves towards privacy in a very progressive, slow way that will be less jarring to, like, if you just say, play ball with, please accept Monero deposits. It's easy for them to say no because it has, all of these bad connotations with it or whatever. But if you just increase the privacy of your coin slowly over the years, then maybe that's a better way to do it.
Yeah. I think the opt-in feature is really, really good in terms of like from a regulator's perspective, right? I mean,
but then it's easy for them to say like, well, why didn't you opt in for ClearNet when you wanted to pay us? You know, like, it's easier for them to, you know,
that might be mandatory, right? For like a Coinbase, they probably won't.
I don't ever.
You'll have to send it, right?
Yeah, I don't ever expect them to take MWeb
from a major
exchange. Yeah,
I mean, because they take it. They like, the fact. Say someone someone has a bunch of Litecoin on MWeb, they get busted because they're doing nefarious stuff. All this MWeb Litecoin will then be transferred to the US. So who is it? The US Marshals or something? Are they the ones that make the big Bitcoin sales? Whatever.
I don't know.
So US government.
It might be alcohol, tobacco, firearms. I feel like it's
So they would peg these things out upon the sale, right? They would peg them out into the clear net upon the auctioning of these seized Litecoin. So like you're able to bring them back out and make them traceable again. And then I feel like that should be enough to satisfy regulators. I feel like, you know, we have to make a best effort to claw back as much privacy as we can from them. I think we're entitled to it. It's our right. And whatever arguments they throw back in our faces about like terrorism or whatever else, nonsense. I mean, we just gotta,
you know, what's funny though, is like, I do find myself, I'm a law abiding citizen for the most part. No, but you know, at some point it does become this issue of we should push for privacy, but I think all of us would agree we don't want people doing, you know, some of the horrible things they'll talk about, right? We don't want trafficking people and trafficking drugs and these, you know, murder for hire or something like that, or stealing from companies by blackmailing them. I don't think that's positive for society in general in any way. But then there's that other side where you say, well, can't the government make everybody a criminal at some point in time? Yes, that's true. So at some point, there's this social layer of at some point in time, we have to agree there's got to be some rules. There's got to be a way to enforce them. And we want to prevent bad actors. But then we also have to keep the government at bay, right? So it's like you almost need to push in both directions. Like,
yeah,
the good money keeps people more honest. I think that's true. And probably more criminals come out of the government than anything start stealing people's money. But go ahead, Matt. Sorry.
I think libertarians would say that hardcore libertarians or anarchists or whatever would say that the greatest good does come from the least amount of laws. And like, even if you lived in a society where, you know, the cost of these measures, of these KYC AML measures, it's far beyond the damage that they inflict. So, for example, if I'm a company, there are many companies that don't operate in entire countries because of the sanctions level threat. So, if I'm a crypto company, I'm not going to operate at all in Venezuela, even though Venezuela is not, if you look in the sanctions list, the entire country is not sanctioned. It's like a select number of people in Venezuela, but most companies will never do business in Venezuela because if they get caught accidentally aiding one person on that list, then it's like, it's over for their entire business and they're done. So they're choosing to cut off 30 million people from accessing their service just so they don't have to deal with the risk of accidentally helping out one of the bad guys. That is when it gets so out of hand. And that's when it starts, you know, impacting entire populations. You know, most of Africa, the rest of the world does a limited amount of business with, because the dollar value that most Africans could present to the business is not high enough to justify the risk of getting, you know, funding terrorism or something. So those laws are wrong and very inhumane. It's like I equate it to kind of carpet bombing in World War II, where you just dump a shit ton of bombs on a city and like, yeah, you're going to achieve your goal, but what is the collateral damage, right? And it's the same thing with these financial laws around, you know, so back to your statement of like, you know, of course, we don't want child pornographers to get away with what they're doing. We don't want human trafficking to get away with what they're doing. But it's very easy to ignore the cost of all of that stuff on innocent people because, mm-hmm. you know, so.
Well, so, but I think it's finding that sweet spot. And, you know, again, I'm not going to sit here and say like MWeb solves all these problems, but, you know, that there's general privacy, but there's also a way, like I look at it as like plausible deniability. Like I think that for the most part, people should be able to keep everything private. But yeah, if there's an investigation into something,
yeah, but that's not how our current system works.
Right? No, I get that. That's what I mean. Like there has to be this balance at some point. We have to push the privacy, and I think just backing down constantly is what's easy to do. But I think as we push, it needs to generate a conversation. And again, I like Monero. I like that Monero exists. Frankly, I think it's a tool that, thank God, it exists long term. It could be a savior in some instance. But I think their hardcore everything private does turn a lot of people off. You know, it can become a hindrance to adoption, hindrance to anybody getting access to it. And like you said, the 30 million people how many people will never see or touch Monero because it's illegal? A lot of them.
Exchanges in their countries don't support it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just going to be, you know, I keep equating it to, it's like an illegal drug. It's like people, white, normal people, 99% of people that are law abiding citizens are just like, you know what? I don't want to mess with it. I got enough going on in my life. I don't need to risk my freedom to buy this coin. What am I getting? You know, it's just not worth it to me. So like, I think that's where maybe this can toe the line of having it. If you want it for your day-to-day transactions, that privacy, great. But maybe it's not as much of a seen as a nefarious thing, I guess.
All right, guys, join us for part 2 on the other episode. As always, thanks again.